but are complexified. And so G is a holomorphic metric on a d-dimensional complex manifold M. And we introduced ambi-twister space then as cotangent bundle. Well, so this is the space of complex nullity at Isix, and we constructed it by taking the cotangent bundle of M, restricting to p squared equals zero, and then taking a quotient by the Hamiltonian vector field of p squared, which gives you the null geodesic. So p squared equals zero gives you null vectors, and p squared is just g mu nu p mu p nu. And somebody at the end sort of asked for an example of what this space looks like. And so I should have had it at my fingertips. So in four dimensions, for example, it turns out that you can realize this space as the cotangent bundle of a three-dimensional projective space. We were working quite a lot with the projectivized version of A, and in which case you just projectivize this cotangent bundle. And so in a conformally flat space, you have a conformal compactification. And in fact, if you projectivize, this is a complex five manifold and compact. So the spacetime can be conformally compactified, complexified, and compactified. So complex conformal spacetime is a compact quadric, it turns out, of four dimensions. And the ambi-twister space is five-dimensional in that case. In general, it's A is 2D minus 2, and projectively then 2D minus 3. And we had the geometric structures, particularly the symplectic potential or contact structure in the projective space. I'll use dots to denote any contraction that's sort of natural. So this is just p mu dx mu, and mu equals 1 to d. And we also have a symplectic structure, omega equals d theta, and a Euler vector field. Quotienting by the Euler vector field gives you projective space and line bundles. So that was the structure that we worked with yesterday, or we developed yesterday. And the main result was that the complex structure on ambi-twister space determines the space-time together with its conformal metric, and that the complex structure is in fact determined by the complex structure is determined by the contact structure theta on the projective space. And so the takeaway result from yesterday was that theta determines mg, the space-time. And I finished with the example that if G is equal to the flat metric plus a momentum eigenstate, so with epsilon being a constant vector and K being a constant vector, then the variation in theta that corresponds to this to that variation in the metric could be written as epsilon dot p squared e to the 2 pi I k dot x times delta bar of k dot p, where delta bar was this double delta function. Delta function of the real part of z times delta function of the imaginary part of z times dz bar. D bar of 1 over 2 pi iz. Okay, and we were thinking of this as an H1 on the projective space with values in the line bundle O1, homogeneous to degree 1 in P. So you can see here that this has weight 2 in P in the front, and the delta bar of K dot P has weight minus 1 because you're taking D bar of 1 over P. Okay, so that was a brief summary of yesterday's talk. Yes. Okay. So this is of course a formula. Yeah. Sorry. It actually does require some explanation because by and large, especially if you're in a curve space, getting your hands on the ambitwister space itself is quite tricky. You're taking a quotient by a distribution by curves, by a foliation by holomorphic curves, and you don't necessarily have all those solutions to hand, and finding a quotient is awkward. So what we tend to do is we actually tend to write everything down on the cotangent bundle of spacetime, and then we restrict p squared equals 0 and make sure that all our calculations are invariant along the vector field x sub p squared, the geodesic spray. So when I write down a formula here, it's actually everything here is a function of p and x. But one of the key features is that you have to have the Lie derivative along x, along the null geodesic spray, delta theta equals 0. And that follows, we're working in flat space now, so xp squared is what I'll write as p dot nabla, but really here I just mean p d by dx. And so you can see that this vector field actually on delta theta vanishes because when you take a derivative of the exponential here, you'll pull down a factor of x dot p, sorry, k dot p. So xp squared, this will give you k dot p, maybe an extra 2 pi I, times epsilon dot p squared e to the 2 pi I k dot x. But then you've got this delta function of k dot p, and that will vanish. So, this vanishes on the support of that delta function. Oh, yeah, sorry, this was just an example. So, so the point is here that being a Fourier state, you generate all possible variations in the metric in that way. Okay, so what we now want to consider are strings in ambitwister space. So we want to consider, but these would be chiral strings. So these are holomorphic, maps from a Riemann surface to I'll be vaguest whether I'm doing projective space or the full space, but we'll. So in order to write down, and the other thing I want to do is I want to actually sort of go to sort of phase space Lagrangian. I'll just say so. We'll have a Lagrangian description. So this is for the bosonic string, just to warn you that there will be supersymmetric analogues in due course. So in this spirit here that we can't necessarily easily write down things on ambitwister space itself, we will work again with the picture that we had up there of the cotangent bundle quotiented by the geodesic flow. So what we'll write down then is, so we'll have a map P X from Riemann surface to, so here sigma is of course Riemann surface. And we'll imagine that it has a complex coordinate, holomorphic coordinate sigma. And the action then is going to be d bar x minus e times p squared. So what we're trying to do in this action is to mimic in a Lagrangian format the Hamiltonian, symplectic quotient that we have in that description up there. So in this, we have E, sorry, first of all, I should explain this formula because as it stands, it's not obvious that this is well defined. So D bar of X is going to give you a 0-1 form. And but what we're going to require is that so maybe the best way to say this is that we'll have a map X going to M, but then P will be a map from well sigma to the canonical bundle tensor T star at X of M. So the point is that P will be a one form on the Riemann surface. So we could think of P as having essentially a D sigma. So K here is equal to omega 1 naught of sigma. And we'll also introduce the tangent bundle on sigma as being K star or T 1 naught of sigma. So in this then, X is a straightforward map to space-time. P is a map to the fiber at X with values in the one forms on the Riemann surface. And so now you can see that this is genuinely a 1-1 form, and you can integrate it over the Riemann surface. And to make this a one, this is a one form squared, P squared is a one form squared now. And so E has to be a 0-1 form with values in T on the Riemann surface. And the role of E is going to be as a Lagrange multiplier. So E has two roles. So the Lagrange multiplier that enforces P squared equals zero, and a gauge field with corresponding to gauge transformations so delta X P is essentially going to be taking you up the geodesic spray, and so here, well, you could think of this as a vector field acting on, sorry, I've been trying to do P then X, but still, acting on P X, and delta of V is equal to d bar of alpha. And here the gauge parameter alpha is a tangent vector on a one naught tangent vector on the Riemann surface, not necessarily holomorphic. So what you can see then is that this is a in writing down a Lagrange multiplier for imposing the condition that the momenta are null, we've actually also inadvertently introduced a gauge field which takes you up and down the null geodesics. And so the we can think of the target. So although, as I've set it out, the target is just the cotangent bundle of M, once we've reduced by the constraint, the target will be ambitwister space. So target restricted to constraint modulo gauge is A. Okay. There's another thing to add here, which is that in string theory, one introduces also Wöhlstreak gravity. And here we have an analog of that. This is a holomorphic string. So Wöhlstreak gravity, so it's chiral. And I've suppressed the field in here. So this D bar operator would, in the usual run of things, depend on a field. So you have D bar sort of sub zero, some background D bar operator plus E tilde times D. And this is also a leads to a constraint. P dot dx now equals zero, and there's a gauge freedom is the so it has the role of a gauge field. So E tilde is also in omega naught one times t, and the gauge freedom is just local diffeomorphisms. So it's essentially coordinate freedom on the Riemann surface. So delta px equals alpha times d of p and x, and etc. Okay, so that's the basic sort of classical model. And what we're going to do then is we're going to quantize this. And so to quantize, we gauge fix E and E tilde to vanish. And there's a standard approach in doing this, which is called BRST quantization. ST leads to ghosts. So here, I mean, I don't want to get into details of it, but when you make a gauge choice, you've got your gauge orbit, and you're taking a gauge fixing, and so the idea is that you're trying to get what you might have expected to get from the quantizing on the quotient under the gauge orbits, but instead you quantize along a slice. But there's a determinant factor that you have to take into account for the volume form, and the BRST, so to speak, does that all for you automatically. And the ghost fields you introduce are essentially opposite statistics to the gauge. So we have B and C and B tilde, C tilde, where C tilde are thought of as models for the gauge freedom, and B, B tilde have to be whatever's dual to that, so that's K squared, and we have action S ghost equals B D bar C plus B tilde D bar C tilde. I don't want to go into too much detail with the BRST, because on the one hand it's sort of a little bit technical, and on the other it's standard. So these are all fermions, and we get a BRST operator where we have C. So if C was for E, then it's C times the constraint that that E gave rise to, and C tilde was the constraint that E tilde gave rise to. And in fact, we often just write T for this. This is a stress energy tensor. And this is T equals sort of P dot dx. But then we end up having to include the stress energy tensor for the C's and B's and C's. So we get some extra stuff there. So they act on themselves. So we get B DC plus B tilde D C tilde over 2. And this is now, if you count up the weights here, this is a one-form squared, C is a vector. So this is just a one-form, and you think of this BRST operator as actually being a contour integral on the Riemann surface. So that's the so the usual idea is this: in order to sort of do the impose the constraints, you're looking at the Q cohomology in the quantum theory. You look at things, states of the Q closed modulo Q exact, and that's somehow automatically looking after the constraints properly for you. And the other thing to mention is, of course, that P and X become quantum fields on the Riemann surface sigma, and this is a conformal field theory. It's only it's a holomorphic quantum field theory, and there are various ways of talking about such things. Usual would be an OPE, where you say there's P at sigma with X at sigma prime. They become singular at sigma and sigma prime when sigma is equal to sigma prime, and that they do so with a pole plus regular. And or another way of saying it is that you have a when you're taking expectation values, we have contractions between them. If you take the expectation value, you'll get delta mu nu over sigma minus sigma prime. And 1 over sigma minus sigma prime is appearing because that is the Green's function for the D-bar operator on the Riemann surface. So what we want to do with this is we want to compute amplitudes. And here we use the analog of the kind of string proposal. So how do we do that? Well, first of all, we're going to work with tree amplitudes. So for tree amplitudes, we require that we're working on a Riemann sphere. And and then what we're going to do is we're going to sort of try to work on a curved background, but only perturbatively. So to work on a curved background, you would write so you take n perturbations of the metric, sort of gi, I equals 1 to n, of metric. So we're going to write, we're going to work about a flat background, g equals eta plus some over epsilon I of GI. This is flat. And then the ansatz for the amplitude that comes out of string theory, so it is a path integral or a correlation function. And so we have, so the amplitude is meant to be the coefficient of epsilon 1 times epsilon 2 up to epsilon n in the path integral. So this is now x, p, etc. And we've got the ghost as well, so I'll if I put dxp, at this stage I'm writing down a very formal expression. So it's divided by the volume of the gauge group. If you've done some gauge fixing, there might still be some residual gauge. And then it's just the e to the I s of x p g. So, sorry, I've been trying to do it the other way around, p x g. Okay, so modulo the definition of a path integral. Here is a formula for the amplitude. So the question is, can we compute this? So this is, I guess this is sort of a striking, what's done in conventional string theory, it's what we're going to do here. It's a striking ansatz in some sense. I mean, if you want to calculate tree amplitudes, somehow, if you're just working with a conventional field theory, what you're saying is that you would make a similar statement, that you're calculating the classical action of this metric G, and then you're just looking at the coefficients of epsilon 1 up to epsilon n. You're expanding to first order in each of these perturbations. So that's what you'd do for a conventional field theory. And so in some sense, what this is trying to tell you is that this is this string formula is the formula for the action of gravity. Well, it would be if this theory gave the correct answer, of course, which it won't. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yes, actually, I did intend to say that. Sorry. Yeah. So Q squared is not always zero. So what I said was we wanted to take the Q cohomology, and Q cohomology is only well-defined if Q squared vanishes. And when you calculate Q squared, you find you get some numbers coming out. You'll get some... Anyway, so Q squared is in some sense gives you the central charge, or central charge times the stress-energy tensor. Well, anyway, Q squared equals zero corresponds to C equals zero, central charge. And but here C is equal to 2 into D minus 26. So this is critical in 26 dimensions. What we'll see is, in fact, this vanishing central charge condition is not very important at tree level, but it certainly becomes important at loops. No, it's an operator. So, so each of those C, P, et cetera, C tildes are operators, and you have to imagine that they're going to be so P and X, C, P, and everything are all operators. They're acting on some Hilbert space. Q is also an operator on that Hilbert space, and one can use these rules here coming from the OPE, or the kind of contraction rule, to compute these OPEs. So what tends to happen is that when you look at Q squared, for example, you'll get various terms coming from the ghosts, and that'll give you the minus 26. And you get various terms coming from the P acting with the X, producing a pole or higher order poles, and they'll give you sort of the various factors of the dimension. And you end up with this formula, 2D minus 26. Okay. So everything I'm doing will have close analogs to conventional string theory. So how do you expand this? Well, just expanding this out to first order and each of these metric perturbations here, then we're going to get your M1 to N is equal to the XP over gauge, or volume of gauge. So we essentially have to bring down one term from the action for each metric perturbation, and we'll end up with the action now just depending on the flat background metric. And of course, working the flat background metric means that we're going to actually be able to perform the calculation. And this, of course, is just d by the epsilon 1, or vi is d by the epsilon I of s xp g, evaluated as epsilon equals 0. And now, this is where the ambi-twister philosophy kicks in, because what we're going to say is that the, what was s? Well, we gauge fixed e and e tilde to be equal to 0. And you then look at what S was. Well, it was just P dot D bar X. Once you've gauge fixed E and E tilde to be equal to 0, and there's not a lot there. I mean, you can't see any dependence on the metric. And but what S is in that gauge fixed context is integral of theta, the contact structure. And so what this is D by the epsilon I of the integral of theta. And so this is where we can pull in our formula, which I think I rubbed out now, for the, so this is d by the epsilon I of theta. And this now, if, so what we will always do, of course, is have these GIs being momentum eigenstates. Epsilon I nu e to the 2 pi I k dot. So apologies for the multiple use of I. There's a square root of minus 1 and the index. And so in that case, then, we can use the calculation we did before to replace this by epsilon I dot p squared times e to the 2 pi I k dot x, k I dot x times delta bar I dot P. And so these new I's are what's called integral vertex, integrated vertex operators. I'll write this as this is a curly new, I'll write the integral of VI, and so these are vertex operators. And then, so this path integral that we get is what, in quantum field theory terms, we mean by taking the correlation function. Although here, I guess I still haven't sort of properly dealt with the gauge. So I'll just write it formally like that. So our task then to compute an amplitude is to take a correlation function of n vertex operators after taking care of the gauge freedom properly. So, okay, in doing this, though, we can see that we've still got quite a computation to do, aside from worrying about the gauge freedom, because I mean, roughly speaking, how do you compute such a correlator? You've got to worry about all the possible contractions between p's and x's, and in this formula for nu, you can see you've got an epsilon dot p in the formula, and we've got all these exponentials in x. So we've got lots of possible singularities that can arise when a p, so to speak, comes in contact with an x. And but there's a trick for dealing with this, which will reduce this to a completely straightforward calculation. So, oh, sorry, before I get there, there are some other things I wanted to say. So the the vertex operators have to be consistent, and we need to have that Q of V equals zero. That's the statement that we can actually quotient by the gauge in the quantum theory, and so in the Q operator, there's in particular the P squared, and we have to think of P in this OPE as really acting on X by differentiation. So so P, morally speaking, goes to d by dx, as one expects from standard quantization, although it would also come with a simple pole, sigma minus sigma prime. And that the P squared, quantum mechanically, see, classically, P goes to P dot d by dx, but quantum mechanically, we also get a d2 by dx squared, a Laplacian. And on V, or, well, maybe on VI, this will give rise to a K squared times some sort of pole, sigma prime squared. And this has to vanish. So this implies that K squared equals zero, and that gives you the that this corresponds to an on-shell condition. And the other feature that one can see coming coming out quantum mechanically is that actually in the definition of the operator, in the definition of V, we've got an epsilon p times that x, e to the 2 pi I. So if we think about the definition of an operator like this, then p and x are actually at the same point. And that's a bit like having a k dot epsilon times divided by zero. And so we need for that operator to be well defined, k dot epsilon equals zero. Now, well, you could Wick order the operator and remove that term, you could regulate it, but then if you were to do so, you'd be at risk of introducing some coordinate dependence. So for quantum consistency, we need k squared equals zero and k dot epsilon equals zero. And this somehow answers the question that we had back in the 70s and 80s as to how do we express the field equations for Yang-Mills gravity and so on in ambi-twister space. It turns out that it's actually the consistency for string theories on that background, or as part of the consistency conditions. We also get these extra rather more stringent ones with the which restrict the dimension, but this is the most naive thing. I mean, this central charge issue is something which to do with the actual world sheet gravity. If you just consider this as a sigma model, then you would only really worry about those sorts of issues. The And there's a mathematical theory of chiral algebras which talks about chiral algebra structures on manifolds. And so in some sense, this characterization of the Fields equations is what that is concerned with. It's concerned with it. So one would say that you do have a structure of a chiral algebra on the full nonlinear ambitwister space, if and only if the field equations are satisfied. And this is just a linear calculation, of course. Anyway, so we've now got to compute this thing to at least show that we make some contact with Freddy's lectures, the CHY formally. So as I was saying, but to compute this, we've got to worry about all of the possible contact between the p's and the x's in those exponentials between the different vertex operators. And to avoid that, we play a trick, which is to handle the exponential terms separately from the rest of the vertex operator. So what we get is the the path integral is just one way of framing. It's a language which we will use for the actual computation, which is alternative to the standard operator language for a correlation function of that form. Yes, that's right. I mean, in the path integral, you could think of them otherwise, but they are essentially going to be operators in the. Absolutely. So that looks like a bad idea. If you're imagining these operators and then computing all the possible contractions between them. So anyway, I'll explain how to get around this and reduce it to essentially a classical computation. So the idea is to take the. So just writing things out in a bit more detail, then, in the path integral language, we're going to. Again, I'm deal with the gauge later. We've got the product I equals 1 to n of these epsilon dot p's, epsilon I, p, sigma I. And we've got an integral over cp1 to the n now, one for each of these. Times. And so what the idea is then is that for each of these, we had a. So this is just writing out sort of explicitly the product of operators. For each of these, we had an exponential factor ki dot p dot x sigma I. And then we had the e to the I action, which is just p d bar x. And that's in fact all we've got at this point. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take these exponentials into the action here. So this here is a function of sigma, but we'll write this extra product of these exponentials will now give rise to a sum over I of 2 pi I ki. Well, if you wanted to write this as an x of sigma here, we'd have to put in a delta function. Which would be sigma minus sigma I. So having looked after those there, I have to rub them out. So those exponentials there turn into that sum there. And now you can see that this product of operators we have here are just all p's, and they all have those all are smooth with respect to each other. They have no singular contact terms, no singular OPE. And so we can now essentially reduce this to a classical calculation. So I guess at this point, the saddle point is going to be exact. So we have a quadratic action and a bunch of operators that commute, and that'll give us an exact that's a context in which we can do the saddle point exactly. And so we have to see what the saddle point is for this action. And so saddle points are where the action is. So you vary p, and you get d bar x equals 0 still. And since we're working on a Riemann sphere, that implies x equals constant. And but now, when we do d bar p, we've got a source term here. So d bar p is going to be equal to some 2 pi I ki delta 2 sigma minus sigma I. And we can integrate this now, and we get p as a function of sigma is going to be equal to ki divided by sigma minus sigma I. And we just use a standard law for the d bar of p is equal to a delta function. And the these are the classical solutions now. So integrate over space of classical solutions. And essentially, just because this action is quadratic, and the operators that we're integrating against are all commuting. So the in this context, we're exact. So. So now we're essentially nearly done. We have the integral over the moduli for the x is just the integral over the constant x's. And they will, so what's left here is essentially just k dot x. And that will give rise to a delta function. So that the integral over dd x gives rise to a delta function of the sum of the momenta. And and the other integrals now, so these are this was an integral over cp1 n times. Will give rise to So we have the delta d sum ki and cp1 to the n 1 over volume of gauge times product over I epsilon I dot p sigma I squared delta bar k I dot p sigma I. And so what we have, in some sense, is the backbone. So these ki. So this is the backbone of all of the scattering equations formally. So P of sigma is this function on the Riemann sphere with simple poles, residues given by the momenta of n particles, and ki dot p sigma I, fortunately, is now non-singular because the pole at sigma I is ki, ki squared is zero, and so this is actually equal to sum over j of ki dot kj, sigma minus sigma j, and this equals zero from the delta function. And these are the scattering equations that Freddie hopefully told you all about. And then the epsilon dot p sigma I, so that's going to give you some function of the polarization data of the external particles. And it turns out that the amplitudes you get from this are garbage, so I won't say too much about this. I should make a few remarks about the 1 over volume of gauge. So the gauge freedom, well, this gauge freedom that I'm worried about here now, we did the gauge fixing with E and E tilde equals zero, but it didn't kill all the gauge. So we have d bar alpha equals zero. You still have alpha was gauge parameter was a tangent vector on the sphere, and we had an alpha and an alpha tilde. So one of these is essentially just the Möbius transformations, PSL2C, Möbius, and the other one is C3. One of them is just the standard coordinate transformations on the sphere. The other one is taking you up and down the nullity of Isaacs still, so that it was the gauge freedom for the E. Now, there's a standard routine for fixing these, which involves introducing fixed vertex operators. And so really, the way that you think about this in quantum field theory language is that you've still got to integrate out by the moduli of the C's. But so I integrate out by the moduli of the X's, but moduli of the C's are still have three-dimensional moduli each. The B's don't. And so you introduce U is equal to C. UI, C sigma I, C tilde sigma I, and there's a standard sort of descent argument, which I don't want to get into, which tells you that you then multiply this by epsilon dot p squared, and this is something that you can insert at one of the marked points without integration. And it turns out to be independent of everything, of the choice of the mark points, and the C's and C tildes provide that their correlation function is a simple product of sigma I minus sigma J's, and it provides what's needed to make this formula completely invariant. So the upshot of this is that the 1 over volume of gauge turns this into the pi prime that Freddie would presumably have written down. Okay, that actually went on much longer than I intended. So just to finish off, yeah.
So there are no Rochian instantons?
Well, there are some zero modes in the X, which you integrate out, but there's no Rochian instantons in this example. Oh, yes, absolutely, yeah. Okay, so maybe just to finish off, I'll tell you how to make contact with some so what I want to say. Okay, so this does give you a formula for some amplitudes that are built out of the scattering equations, but what you discover is that this corresponds to a gravity theory which is going like sort of r plus r cubed or something. And we haven't really clarified what it is. But it's not a very physical gravity model, and by and large, we've ignored it. We've regarded it, these particular amplitudes as being pathological. So that means that it corresponds to, what I really mean is that if you look at the three-point amplitude here, it depends on, P is going like a power of the momenta. If you've got a three-point amplitude, you've got six powers of the momenta. So you've got six derivatives in play at a three-point amplitude. To get that, you need to have an R cubed term in the action. That's what I mean. So it's a very naive statement. Okay, so how do we get more physical amplitudes? So eventually, I'm certainly going to show you how to do gravity properly, although not today. But what we're going to do is to introduce some world sheet matter. So world sheet matter. And so we're going to have a S full. In fact, we're going to do, we'll have our bosonic action. We'll actually have two separate pieces of world sheet matter. We'll have an SL and an SR. And I'll be more specific about what they are tomorrow. And these will lead to vertex operators, which are JL times J. Well, sorry, actually, I think I'll call them. That's meant to be a big V. This would be little VL times little VR times e to the 2 pi I k dot x delta bar k dot p. So what we saw here is we had an epsilon dot p squared. And epsilon dot p is a one form on the Riemann surface. So these will, the VLs will both be in k. So you need a one form squared. So we have enough room to put in two one forms or currents in the vertex operators. And in good situations, we will have some symmetries that impose that these have to be of the chosen form, one from VL, one from SL, and one from SR. And just a very quick example, I won't write down the actions, but there's such an object as a current algebra, so e.g. current algebra. So there are lots of actions for current algebra, so I don't need to specify them. So J takes values in one forms on the Riemann surface, tensor sum Lie algebra. And these are constructed so that they have an OPE, J sigma prime, is equal to delta. Sorry, this is, that's meant to be a kappa over sigma minus sigma prime squared. So maybe I'll put an index on this. Plus C A B C J C sigma over sigma minus sigma prime plus regular. And then with these, we can have two such, so we can have a JL and a JR. So we can take these Vs to be these currents. And the key point here will be that we can do the computation of the correlators of the VL separately from the VRs. These are decoupled actions. And so I should really stop now, so I'll just state it and maybe explain in more detail in the next lecture. So this will give rise to the biadjoint theory that, with trivalent diagrams that Freddie talked about. And but then what we'll see tomorrow is that to get gravity, you need to introduce world sheet supersymmetry. And then there are various combinations of these things that you can take, which give you all sorts of other theories. And but my time's up, so I better stop there today. Thank you.
So it seems like by choosing actions and vertex operators well, one can match up these expectation values with scattered amplitudes.
That's right. So what we'll what we'll find is when you put world sheet supersymmetry in, this will get a correction, which will make it correct for gravity. And maybe what I should have said here is that this will be replaced by the correlator V1 to Vn on the left side, and well, there's VLs, and V1 to Vn on the right side. And these will give rise to the various ingredients that that appear in the CHY form.
So this theory using this epsilon dot p square, is it? Do you know what's the actual corrections to Einstein gravity, or is it problematic?
I suspect the theory is deeply problematic. I mean, all I'm saying here is that you've got to have an R cube term just to explain the three-point vertex.
Okay.
And it could be that, I mean, one of the ways that a string theorist might internalize what's going on here is that they would say that you've got the tachyon is something that corrupts conventional string theory. And although with in setting alpha prime equal to zero, the mass of the tachyon has been sent off to minus infinity. It's somehow maybe doing something with the stuff that's going to plus infinity, and it's bad news. It's just creating some junk in the amplitudes. On the other hand, I mean, the supersymmetry protects you from that, and so when you throw in world sheet supersymmetry, then the epsilon dot p gets a correction, which is exactly what you need. That's not a very mathematical answer, but it's, that would be the physicist's answer.
What other kinds of space-time have been considered or will be considered besides the four space?
I'll say something very briefly about curved space. So there is a curved space calculation, which is just in some sense a general curve space, and that calculation is concerned with showing that the full. So here, in some sense, I gave a linearized calculation to say that in linear theory, that the constraints are consistent cross mechanically if the linear fields are satisfied with field equations. And you can actually carry that calculation over to curve space. So that was done by the Cambridge group last year. You can actually see all of the full nonlinear corrections coming in, and you get a perfect result. So the full equation, I mean, it's a 10-dimensional result. It's a full equations of type 2 supergravity 10-dimensional. So it's the consistency of this string theory on a curved background with the supersymmetry.